Okay.
Do you want another drink?
Oh. Can we move this over at all?
Okay, check out later on.
Spotter that much, you know. I see what I, you know. I see what I see. I learn what I learn. I don't know. Maybe there are such things. It sounds like a great idea. It sounds like a good idea. I think in general, to share religious holidays with one another, with different, you know, in different spiritual communities, to join in celebration when, you know, when one or the other of them has a holiday. And you know, but that requires a kind of a previous sense of networking with the local spiritual communities around you, the non-Buddhist communities and Buddhist and non-Buddhist communities around you. So that would, I think, be a first step, is to start extending an interest in the other communities, and to try to feel a sense of camaraderie with the Christians and the Jews and the other spiritual groups in your local community. That's a really good question, and my best answer to that is that the boundaries come when it no longer works. You see, the criteria for what is a valid practice is, does it work? Does it bring the happiness to people that they're looking for? And and harming other people doesn't. Practice of peace does. You see, lying to other people doesn't. Telling the truth does. And these are universally recognized, you know, kinds of practices in the religious traditions. And so inclusive Buddhism would reach out to any kind of articulation of those kinds of beliefs and practices that bring a better life to people. Of course, it wouldn't reach out to those that don't. So understandings, either non-religious or religious, understandings and practices and beliefs that separate people, that hierarchize people, that harm people or harm themselves, you know, this is not Dharma. It's not true. It's not the truth. It's not the truth as explained in Buddhism, and it's not the truth as explained in any of the authentic religious traditions. So it's not when we're talking about syncretism, we're not talking about mindless eclecticism. Okay, those are different. Syncretism and unprincipled eclecticism are different. Syncretism reconciles and harmonizes, you know, the different articulations of the truth, the different articulations of what works to bring a happier life. Mindless eclecticism just sort of is like a big sponge and says, yeah, whatever, you see. It's the whatever approach. Everything is everything, or something like that. And everything is not everything, you know. That's obviously not true. So it's not this kind of, like, mindless relativism, where you just say, well, you know, because some people say it, it's, you know, it's their truth, and so, you know, there's no way to evaluate truth claims. There is a way to evaluate truth claims. Do they work? You see? Do they function to bring a happier, more content, more peaceful life to the people who are practicing those truth claims? Or not? You see? And to the people around them, too, you see? So it's not just this kind of, like, non-discriminatory sponge that just, like, takes everything in. It's not unprincipled eclecticism, but you might call it principled syncretism. Principled syncretism. And that's inclusive Buddhism, I think. That's one understanding of it, anyway. Maybe we should move on to Nashville. Is that all right? Nashville, whenever you guys are ready, K-Pan, maybe you guys can turn off your camera now. Yeah, there you go. There's Nashville. Hi. Need some sound from you, David. I can't hear.
Okay. Yay! First of all, thank you. Awesome and amazing. Lots to think about, lots to talk about. Brother Ryan has some questions. Second of all, I really dig the shaved head beard look. It's the new in. I guess thirdly, how would you like us to advertise classes? Do you just say, like, a spiritual daily practice, or do you actually throw in there Buddhist daily practice? Or do you say Dharma essentials, or just how do you word the advertising of classes to bring everybody in?
Thanks, Ryan. That's a good question. And I don't think that there's one cookie-cutter answer to that. Some of what you're talking about, I think, we'll return to in the third talk called Pragmatic Buddhism and how to bring Buddhism, the Buddhist principles, into our daily lives. You know, but there are different, you know, you're in different communities. You know, you have to have a sensibility of who's there, who's in your community and what they're going to best respond to. I think it's perfectly possible, you know, especially in places like Singapore, I mean, obviously, that people will respond very, very favorably to Buddhism, to quite overt advertisements of, this is a Buddhist class on Buddhist text on this and that, Buddhist, that's fine. That refers to the first of the four understandings of inclusive Buddhism. So you identify yourself as Buddhist, but you think about what the hell that means. You know, you think about it as an inclusive category, not an exclusive one. An inclusive identifier, not an exclusive one. But in other situations, in other communities, where the Buddhists are, in the tiny, tiny minority, self-identified Buddhists are in a tiny, tiny minority, maybe that's not going to be the best way to do it. And to, to keep it all encoded in a technical language, in a foreign language, dharma essentials. Dharma is not an English word. Even now it's pretty common. It's like almost at the status of karma, not quite. But still, it's a Sanskrit word. What do you mean by dharma? Dharma essentials. Well, why can't we think about translating that into our own language, you see, in such a way that it underlines the fact that this is relevant. It is relevant to to us in our daily lives, no matter who we are, no matter which culture we live in, and so forth. And especially in, you know, in non-Buddhist cultures, this seems to me to be a much more effective way of reaching out to the people that we want to help, which is everybody, not just some. Okay. Again, I mean, don't forget, it's not just all sentient Buddhists that we are supposed to have compassion for. All sentient beings, not all sentient Buddhists. So up to you guys, I think, in your own local communities to decide what's going to be most effective, both in terms of your, you know, labeling of your courses and what kinds of things you have at your centers, what kind of ornamentation, what kind of tankas you have up there, what kind of statues, you know, is it off-putting to the people who walk in, or is it, you know, something welcoming, you know? And that's a local call, I'd say. But we'll talk more about this in the third talk, I think, on pragmatic Buddhism, okay?
Thank you very much. Awesome. Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks, okay. Nashville. So good to see you guys. Rick, let's go to Saskatoon, please. It's really dark there in Saskatoon. Oh, there you go. Need some sound from you, Sonia.
Oh, can you hear me now? For myself, it's a little bit confusing how to balance your practice, like if you're practicing a tradition, and to remain non-attached to it. Like, how would that look practically in your everyday life?
I think it's just simply a matter of like this, that you're practicing, you know, a set of guidelines or a set of practices that you've learned from a tradition, yoga tradition, Buddhist tradition, Christian tradition, whatever tradition it is, recognizing that these practices and these ways of thinking, these ways of believing and so forth are one way of doing it, and that there are many others. There are many others that are potentially equally effective, and that you don't fall into the trap of the exclusive fundamentalist idea that your way is the only way. So you can be practicing, you know, your Buddhism as Buddhism. You see, you're practicing Buddhism as Buddhism, but what is it that you're actually practicing when you're practicing Buddhism? Are you practicing a mode of life that is more conducive, more inclusive, more conducive to understanding the brotherhood and sisterhood that we all share as human beings, or less conducive to that? More inclusive in your compassion? You know, is it teaching you to be more inclusive in your compassion, more flexible in your thinking, more tolerant, or less so, you see? And if it's less so, then I think it's a problem. It's not a solution. It's no longer like pragmatically working. If it's understood and practiced in this kind of exclusive way, it doesn't work to bring the goal that all the traditions, you know, are moving towards, which is some sense of shared common universality that connects us all to one another, not separates us off from each other. Okay, so it's a little, you know, it's tricky, but it's not that tricky. It's, you know, you can, I mean, I certainly have done it, I think, for most of my life. You know, have when I've practiced a tradition, as I have for the last 14 years with Buddhism, understanding that this is just one way, understanding quite clearly from my own experience, actually. You know, my experience with Christianity, my experience with Hinduism, understanding that the Buddhist modality, the Buddhist method, the Buddhist language, the Buddhist articulation, is just one finger, one kind of finger pointing to the moon. But that other fingers can point to the same moon too. But you're using this finger. That's all. To recognize that your finger is just one finger. And there's a whole hand. At least, maybe two hands. Okay.
Can I ask just another part to it then? Okay. So, I've talked about in the past is the importance of sticking to one tradition and learning one thing well so that get to the root of it, and how would that, I can see that it might be when you're trying to be inclusive of all things, tricky to not actually, if you're open to all of them.
In my own experience, that's a very good question, Sonia. It's a very good question. In my own experience, it has been because I have been able to understand deeply the three traditions that I have some familiarity in: Hinduism, Christianity, and Buddhism. It's by understanding each one of those deeply that I'm able to see the similarities in all of them, to see the overlaps and similarities in all of them. It's only through understanding them very deeply that I personally, in my own life, have been able to, to come to the position that I'm at now, which is to feel that it's rather easily, that they're rather easily reconcilable and synchronizable. So that's my own experience, and that I would transmit also to people who are interested, who ask questions like you did. Yeah, it would be much better, I think. It is much better, to learn a tradition very, very deeply, a one tradition very, very deeply, so that you can, from that standpoint, from that deep understanding of a tradition, so that you can then see that your tradition is basically a finger pointing to the same moon that other fingers are pointing to. But if you are going to get steeped in a religion, in any one tradition, it's important to try to remember that's the purpose of it. The purpose of it is to not get enfolded into the details of your tradition, but to see how the details of your tradition lead you outside of your tradition as well. Okay? And then you're in a position of becoming an undo. You see, for that fourth category, for the undo category, you have to have a tradition. You have to be steeped in a tradition for you to undo it. But the purpose of all traditions is not to get, all involved in the finger, but to try to get to the moon that the finger is pointing to. And when you get to that point in any one tradition, when you realize that they're just a finger pointing to a moon, you can see very, very, with more clarity, I think, than you could before, that the other fingers are doing the same thing. Okay? All right, thanks, Saskatoon. Thanks for coming, you guys. All right, let's move to Reno. Hi. Hi, guys.
Hi, I'm
Shane. Oh, doing something. They're doing the Harlem Shake. I think the Harlem Shake is a lot cruder than that. It's a lot more suggestive than that. You guys did a very PG version of the Harlem Shake, I think.
exciting about it, which is more inclusive to me, which I think is critical that you're discussing. And I'm just wondering, what are the nuts and bolts for us, especially as we've been going through Yeti courses, and now we have a new curriculum about to begin. What are the nuts and bolts for us in terms of our own practice and transition?
Well, of course, that's going to be different for every individual, I'd say. But here's a suggestion that the transition is from a practice of Buddhism to a practice of what the Buddha taught. You see, a practice of putting it into practice, rather than getting attached to the practice, to putting it into practice. And these talks are intended to help break out of the help us all to break out of the tendency that we all have to get enclosed in our certainties, to get enclosed in our isms, and instead of practicing what those isms are trying to get us to practice, which is beyond isms. Which is beyond the kind of, you know, vertical containers of saying, you know, well, I'm a Buddhist, but that's a Hindu and that's a Christian and all like that. Okay? So the nuts and bolts question is, you know, what would the Buddha do? You know, how would the Buddha understand, you know, what you think is Buddhism, you see? What would the Buddha do? What would Christ do? What would Jesus do? How would the great saints and mystics practice what we call religion? And, you know, there's no examples in world history of the great mystics going to war with each other. There's no examples of Sufi mystics, you know, fighting, you know, Hindu mystics. It's the keepers of the orthodoxies who fight with one another. It's they who are killing each other. It's they who are giving religion a bad name, you could say. So let's try to practice our religion, not cling to it. Let's try to not identify ourselves so thoroughly with it. You see, you know, if you want to identify with yourself as a Buddhist, as I said, please do. But think about what that means. What does it mean to be a Buddhist? How are you going to live as a Buddhist, not just like vogue around as a Buddhist, saying I'm a Buddhist, I've done 18 courses, I graduated, I'm a graduate Buddhist now. So, like, what, you know, what is all that? It's just some other kind of way to feel better about yourself, or to feel superior to other people, or to feel different than other people. If your Buddhism hasn't taught you how to feel more connected to other people, but is teaching you how to feel less connected, then it's no good anymore. It's no use. It's no good. Throw it away. It'd be better to be a secular humanist and to love other beings, all beings, than to be a Buddhist and just say, oh, and I only like Buddhists, and the rest of them can, you know, the rest of them are wrong or inferior or something like that, you see. Better to be to be non-identified with anything, and to be living a good life with a good brain, with a good head, than to be self-identified Buddhist with all of the kinds of mental afflictions that many of us carry around that identification. I hope that's a little helpful. Okay, thanks. Thanks, Reno. Thanks for joining us. All right, so let's go down to LA. Okay, go ahead, one more question.
Concepts, and that's the wider population. With
Yeah, that's also that's a nice question. Oh, sorry, did I cut you off, Peter? I'm sorry. No, I can't hear him. Well, I think I got your question. Can you hear me okay, Peter? Okay. I think I got your question. I might have lost the last bit of it, so forgive me if I don't address that. But yeah, your question is an interesting one. I don't know that there's anything that any one of us can do individually or even as a, you know, as a set of communities to try to integrate, you know, a foreign word into the English language more. You know, that will occur organically or not. You know, I don't know that any of us are like have any kind of like the ability or power to sort of, you know, force Dharma into the English language as a coherent term. It may happen, it may not. Karma is already karma and yoga have already become integrated in the English language. You know, in a little bit of an unfortunate way. Because then, you know, people don't really think they understand what those terms have meant in the past in Asian societies, but they don't. I mean, you know, they've taken on a specific and somewhat distorted meaning from their original understanding, you know, in Asian societies as they've gotten integrated into the you know, common parlance of English speakers. So that's one way to answer your question. Here's another way, and this one again points to the third talk, the pragmatic Buddhism talk, and that is whether or not for us as individuals, as individual practitioners, you know, what's going on by our refusal to translate those terms? You see, why can't we, you know, in our own discourse, in even internal discourse, why can't we find equivalents in our own language for those terms? You see, I think that at least at some level, that by not translating those terms into common English concepts, that we're keeping them at arm's length, that we're keeping them from ourselves, you see, from having any kind of real penetration into our own understanding of how Buddhism could infect our own lives. So we're keeping it a little bit quarantined in our own understanding, in our own minds, quarantined by keeping those foreign words foreign and by not translating them. So we'll come back to that. It's a very interesting and I think a very important whole set of issues around the whole question of language and translation that we want to talk about, I think, in May again. So thanks for asking. All right, so let's go down to LA now. LA, are you there? Can you guys hear me? Rick, if you can't, I'm gonna ask to go to another place soon. And then we can come back to LA maybe. Oh, there you go. Hi, LA. Looking good down there as usual.
We just wanted to know where you want to go to next.
Sure. Need some volume from you, Rick.
We have a special guest questioner for you. What's that?
More volume, please.
Hear me okay?
No, more volume, please.
More tail bell. How about now?
Not much different than before.
More.
Okay,
well,
No, that's good, Rick.
Okay,
that's,
here we go.
That's fine.
Bring the camera down a little bit.
Hello, Lama Marut and Cindy. Just didn't want to waste this opportunity to say hello and to tell you how much I miss you and adore both. And I have been getting to know some of your students in Reno and here at Mahasukha Center that You know, I've wanted to come here for, since this was a gleam in your eye, and I just know how proud you are of all these people, and I can understand why. So, I just want to caution you, don't tinker with this thing too much, because what you're doing seems to be really working.
Thank you for teaching meditation, Doug. We wish we could come.
Thanks for teaching in L.A. and Reno and Vancouver and all the places that you're teaching. You're really helping a lot of people, Doug. And what you're teaching, I think, is a little bit of an example of what I'm talking about when I'm talking about inclusive Buddhism, as I understand what you're doing.
Yeah, it seems that way to me, too, so I'm very happy that we're on the page because I'm having the time of my life. I hope you are, too. We have a question, too. Can you feel one?
Yeah.
Thank you, Lama Mara, so much for your teaching. I wanted to ask a question that I'm not sure if it's going to make sense, so maybe it doesn't, but I was thinking about, for instance, Australia. You mentioned how over there there's more people that don't have a religion, right? And I was thinking in places that, or in certain places in Europe, when that happens, that phenomenon that has happened, makes them feel that they don't have a religion. And do you, in your view, or in your experience, because you're also living in Australia, do they, the reaction towards society, are they are they more integrated? Does that make maybe that society or that country be more inclusive because they've maybe chosen that path or they're going through that phenomenon of not being like a part of a religion? I'm just wondering if you felt that or maybe that doesn't.
Yeah, that's a very interesting question, and I don't know that I can really answer it. I don't know I'm capable of answering it. I think certainly theoretically it's possible for people, if they shed one kind of exclusive understanding of religious affiliation, if they shed that, then they open up the possibility of feeling more connected to others. Than less. I think that's a possibility. But then there's also, you know, it's a complicated situation because then, you know, in those very same secularized countries, it's also possible for an increased understanding of nationalism, for example. You know, so they just move from one kind of group affiliation to another, which also separates people, you know. Or it's possible for people who have dropped religious affiliation to feel very decentered and insecure and at sea and don't know, you know, what to do. It's also possible for people who've dropped a formal affiliation to feel much freer. So I don't think that there's any easy, you know, kind of generalization to be drawn here about what happens in places where religion is really dying. The formal affiliation to religion is really dying. But it is certainly the case. It is the case in where I'm staying now, where I'm living now. It's the case in much of Western Europe. It is, I think, on the rise even in places like the U.S., where, you know, people are disaffiliating with religion at a, you know, an increased rate, as I sort of, you know, mentioned in the statistics. And there are, I think, a lot of maybe good reasons for that. You know, none of us are unaware of the fact that, you know, religious intolerance and exclusivism has brought us a lot of trouble and continues to bring us a lot of trouble in the world. And not just, you know, in places like Afghanistan or Iraq, but, you know, at home too. You know, where people's exclusivist understandings of religion just lead to violence, leads to hatred, leads to disharmony, not to harmony. And maybe people, and then of course the whole sort of history of, you know, recent history of scandals in the Roman Catholic Church, but in other forms of organized religion too. And maybe people are just sort of saying, like, enough of this already, you know? This is a this is an institution that has, you know, that is no longer valuable. A formalized religious institution is no longer valuable to us. And so there's lots of possible reasons for why people might be disaffiliating from religion, but the fact is that they are. And so those of us who are interested in trying to share what we know can bring a happier life, which is through the spiritual life, then we have to figure out ways to address people in non-denominational or even non-religious whatsoever language. And that's, I think, quite possible. And there's lots of different kinds of trends on, lots of different kinds of possibilities being explored right now as to how we can do that, including very much the, you know, what His Holiness the Dalai Lama is doing. So I don't know, that's a long-winded answer or possible partial answer to what you were asking, I think, maybe. Anyone else from LA got a question? If not, then let's move to Melbourne.
I think we're going to let you go. Singapore. Ciao.
Okay, bye guys. Thank you. Let's move to Melbourne first.
Lindsay. Oh, go ahead to Melbourne.
No. Go ahead, Lindsay. Is that you, Lindsay?
Yes, Lindsay. Yeah. I got the floor. Okay. I just wanted to say that the whole process of this, during this very powerful year for all of us who are in centers and have come out of ACI, it's been a year of really being turned in on ourselves in terms of learning how to trust ourselves and how to ask ourselves the important questions of ourselves now. Some of us are young and haven't been in the process only a short time, and some of us a longer time. But what we are seeing in you is coming from us. And I just want to say that I think it's very exciting. I think it indicates a tremendous growth in us. I think it indicates that we are trusting ourselves. And I really look forward. Those of us who have been teaching ACI will continue to teach ACI, I know, because it's what we know, Lama Maru. But I know that we will move towards teaching what you have to say, what Geshe Michael has had to say, in our own way, and that's what we're starting to stand for. And I want to thank you, because I think that means a spiritual maturity. Whatever age anyone is in these groups, or however long they've been in contact, I think that is encouraging.
Well, thanks for the comment, Lindsay. And yeah, I agree. It's a very potentially a very exciting time, a very challenging but exciting time. And the excitement and as well as the challenge comes from letting go of old truisms and old securities, and being finding a little more comfort in feeling a little less secure. And of course, we all like resist that. You know, what is it? Hammer and tongs. We all resist letting go of something that we feel has brought us, you know, some sense of stability, some sense of security. But that's not Buddhism. That's not Buddhism under any definition of Buddhism, is to get secure. It is the groundlessness that defines Buddhism, as the lakshanas indicate, the three lakshanas. The fact of impermanence and the fact of there not being essences to things, and the fact that we suffer by grasping to things as if they were permanent and have essence. This is Buddhism. This is the real teaching of Buddhism. And so if we're actually going to try to practice that, we have to practice letting go. We have to practice stopping clinging and grasping to whatever it is that we're clinging or grasping to, very much including Buddhism itself. And the more we're able to do that, the happier we'll be. And that's I can say that, you know, with some conviction, because I have had some glimpse of it in my own experience, and I think probably many of you have too, that the more we're able to let go, the more we're able to, you know, to stop the grasping, to stop the clinging, to stop the wish that things wouldn't change or would change the way we wanted them to change, the more we can stop thinking that there are essences to things, you know, that define them and that are unchangeable, the more we can stop that, the happier we'll be. And that's a functional thing, you see. That's Dharma. That's the way that Dharma functions. That's pragmatic. That works. And if you don't believe me, try it. You see, try letting go more and stop grasping less. And you will see that it leads to a happier life. And we all have some form of this. We're all doing it. We're all grasping. We're all clinging. That's why we're suffering. And so it's a bit of an exercise, you know, that we go through individually and collectively to learn how to be free. To learn how to be freer by grasping less, clinging less, and being more comfortable with insecurity and groundlessness, and not nostalgic for a security that was never secure anyway. The whole idea of security is an illusion. The whole idea of ground is an illusion. There's never been any ground or security. So the reconciliation with insecurity and groundlessness is actually the reconciliation with reality. The truth shall set us free, not illusion.
Thank you. We'll head you over to Melbourne. You can go scan by while I switch the settings.
Is my mom and dad there?
I haven't come on yet.
I'm not still
it. It's just LA. It's a good turnout in LA.
Great.
There they are.
Oh! Hi, Mom and Dad! Oh.
Hi, guys. Both up. Good to see you.
We can't hear you.
So you have to turn on your microphone now. We'll turn ours off.
Is Auntie Anne there as well?
Yeah.
Hi, Auntie. Thanks for coming.
So, look, do you guys have any questions at all? It's great to see you all there. Thanks for coming.
We're good. You've answered all my questions.
All right, that's great. All right, so we'll see you all in live in person in Melbourne in just a couple of weeks, I think. So let's move to... Let's move to Singapore, last but not least. Yeah, there they are. Hi, Singapore. Good to see you guys. Thanks for waking up so early. Joining us. Chuck, are you able to figure out your sound? You've had problems in the past. I can't hear anything you're saying. So if you get a chance, turn on your sound now if you have any questions or comments. Just barely. Can you amp it up a little bit?
Mm.
No. How you doing, Chuck? You think you're going to manage the sound?
You can type it into the chat. Hmm.
Yeah, maybe you'll want to type into your chat room again. You guys should figure out like what the sound problem is there. This is the second or third meeting that we've had by now, so maybe one of your wonks over there, can figure out. It's supposed to be like a high-tech Asian miracle society there. How come you can't figure out how your computers work? The Asian miracle is turning out to be kind of a dud. Anyway, why don't you guys go ahead and try and type in. If you have any questions, go ahead and type them in on the public chat. And then, do spend some time, in the next couple of weeks figuring out what the deal is there. Maybe you can work with Rick a little bit and he can help you, Chuck. Thanks and sorry. That's okay. No questions? All right. We'll see you guys in Singapore, actually in Bintan Island, in just a couple of weeks. Thanks for coming so early in the morning and joining us for the teaching, and we'll see you in person in just a couple of weeks. Good to see you, JJ. You're back in town, huh? All right, guys. I think that wraps it up. Thank you all for joining us. Thank you all for participating in these talks. I hope that they're useful. I hope that the different local people can share the audio at least of these talks with people who in the communities who weren't able to come today. Please, work with me directly if you have any difficulties that way. But if you have a website, please post the audio on the website. If you don't have a website, please make sure that interested parties locally who want to hear it can get the audio so that people can hear what was said. And we'll look forward to seeing everybody in early May. I don't have the exact dates, but I guess you guys probably do. If you don't, we'll be passing those out via email, reminding you soon. Early May sometime, right? Mm-hmm. First weekend in May, I think. Until...
19th of May.
Oh, is it 19th of May, Cindy saying? 18th, is it the Saturday 18th?
Saturday the 18th.
Saturday the 18th, Sunday the 19th for those of us in Asia or Australia. So we'll see you then on the internet, and some of you will see in person in Singapore and in Melbourne very, very soon. And we'll see the rest of you guys in North America this summer, and looking forward to that. So thanks again, and thanks especially to Rick for all his hard work on the technical end of things. Okay? So see you soon. Is that right? Did I do everything right?